Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey folks, two quick things before we start. First, Dr. Jake Meyer was not a professor, but instead a lecturer at a number of the universities that I cited. Second, we are doing a big fundraiser. So we have been working hard for 5 years. As you might know, Xander, I, Nat, anyone associated with Reconsider has never gotten a dime out of the money that's flowed in. We always use it. This is a labor of love. We do it for free. We don't get paid. What we want to do now is massively expand our audience. And that means paying for marketing. I don't have time. Nobody has time. I don't have expertise. But we found a partner who's really, really good. And what we want to be able to do is keep working with this partner and get the Reconsider message out to more people. We think it's more important now than ever. And we're sort of at this like grow or die moment. What that means is we need support from many of you. We sent out an email. I know not everyone's on the email list, and the response was absolutely overwhelming. We were amazed and humbled, frankly. I was hoping that some of you that are not on the email list that haven't seen that would also be willing to go to Patreon and contribute. We ask everyone who's a regular listener, if you can, drop a buck a show. If you want a shout out, $2 is great. And there's great perks at higher prices. So please, if you could, go to patreon.com/reconsider. Your support would mean the world to us. Now, on to the show. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Reconsider, part of the Agora Podcast Network, where we don't do the thinking for you. I'm your host, Eric, and I have the delight to welcome back Dr. Jake Meyer, PhD economist extraordinaire, who's joined us a number of times on the show to help us understand what the heck is going on in the world around us. And we keep a strong relationship with Jake. And of course, sort of those of you who follow us, as time has gone on, like the macroeconomics that we used to all take for granted have just like kept changing in ways that my financial advisor, for example, is like ready to jump out a window over. And when Jake and I were last catching up, we figured this was a great opportunity. You know, new president, pandemic's ending, lots of new like technology entering the finance space that kind of changes the whole game. You know, Bitcoin is even bigger than the last time everyone said it was overvalued. All sorts of odd stuff going on, or at least conventionally odd. And I was hoping, you know, I asked Jake if he could help us with a few questions that we thought might be interesting to y'all to try to understand, get a big picture of what's going on in the global economy. And he, of course, agreed to join. So, Jake, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Yeah, thank you for having me on again.
So, Jake, what I actually want to first start with is tell us a little bit about Swiss Re. Last time we chatted, you're at UBS. You've, of course, been a professor at Columbia and at Claremont. So you've done a ton of stuff teaching people. Oh, right. And Cal State Long Beach, I forgot. And so you've done a ton of work teaching people how economics works over the past decade plus. And what I'd like to understand a little bit more is what are you doing right now?
So at the moment, I'm at Swiss Re, as you mentioned. And Swiss Re is a reinsurance company, which is more or less an insurance company for insurance companies. And then given the given just the nature of the insurance market and the fact that Swiss Re manages their own assets, the macro outlook is of course very important for the firm. So I'm here focusing on the macro outlook for the U.S. and Canada, right?
Cool. And when I thought macro outlook as we were preparing for the show, one of the first things I thought was, so I have, I have some investments and I have a financial advisor who helps me manage them. I'm a big mutual fund guy myself, but trying to diversify. And every now and then, this financial advisor and I catch up about the macro environment. As I mentioned, he's like ready to jump out a window right now because he's a big values fundamentals guy. Austrian's not quite the word for him, but like he's like an old school guy, and he's been really frustrated with stuff like PE ratios and other stuff that he thinks like that he thinks has the like at least the stock market kind of all out of kilter, and he's been feeling this way for years. And I think what's so interesting about those conversations with him is that clearly he's been doing this for a long time, for decades. And so it feels to me, talking to him and doing my own reading, that like the US macro environment is behaving somehow differently than the way it used to. Like it feels like there's been a departure somewhere. And I guess like, let's just say that, I don't know, like you were an economist in 1999 and you like went into a coma and then you woke up. You didn't see all this change over the past 22 years and you popped up and looked around. Like, what would that person, what that economist who just woke up, like what would their first impression be, or what would they say about what they're seeing now?
You know, that's a tough one. And I think there's a couple of interesting directions to go with on that one. So I think the first would probably be, and this is a little more of kind of a dive into the kind of the history of economic thought a bit, but in the 90s and the early 2000s, there was this whole idea in the economics community that like we had beat the business cycle to a certain extent, right? Like we were in this great moderation and things like that. And then of course, as we all know, but this economist, doesn't. There was a big crash in the early 2000s with the collapse of the dot-com bubble, and then of course a way larger business cycle event in the late aughts with the housing market collapsing. So I think the one thing that would be interesting for that economist to look at, or perhaps a little bit shocking, is how their perceptions about what was about the nature of stability and the business cycle and stability in financial markets was, rather wrong, in that time period. But I think what would probably be even more interesting is how the standard economic orthodoxy about the recovery from these types of events has changed in the time since. So if you look at the recovery from, in particular, after the collapse of the housing market, there was just an unprecedented monetary stimulus, largely unprecedented fiscal stimulus that was really being pushed out. And then in the standard economic orthodoxy thought at that time would have been to say that, well, this large scale fiscal stimulus, this large scale monetary stimulus is going to drive up inflation. It's going to generate these sort of overheating conditions. And instead we saw the opposite. We saw very, very low inflation for a long period of time. We saw this. We saw very low growth for a long period of time, and I think that what's probably the most interesting element of this right now is how the economics community, learning from that experience, has changed their perspective on what's happening right now at this moment. And I think what's happening at this moment is what would be most shocking to this economist, where we've introduced something like $6 trillion in fiscal stimulus in the past year or so, with the five phases of stimulus, and we've engaged in unprecedented monetary interventions as well, with the idea that when we tried this after the housing boom. And then it wasn't enough. Fiscal stimulus wasn't enough. Monetary stimulus. We have to go bigger, right? So first off, these headline numbers would be shocking to this economist that went into a coma in 1999. but I think there's a strong argument to be made that the economist from 1999 might actually be a little bit more right than the people who lived through the recovery from the housing crash, because there seems to be a possibility that we might have learned the wrong lessons from that experience in 2008, where if you look at why that inflation was low, why you had that growth drag, it's because we were in the middle of this like deleveraging cycle, where everyone who had a house that was say $400,000, the value went down to $200,000, and they lost a lot of net worth. Right? You had companies unloading debt. You had everyone selling, driving down prices, driving down balance sheets and such, and that was the reason for the drag. Whereas what we see now is something completely different, right? This is not a balance sheet driven crisis. It's a it's a virus that came out of nowhere and the global economy like shut down for about a year. And so I think there's a fairly strong argument to be made that this, economists waking up in 1990 and being shocked by the size of the stimulus that we're seeing now might actually be correct to a certain extent. And we might be seeing that the approach that we're taking right now with maybe not the earlier stimulus packages, but the later ones and the infrastructure package right now, that we're attempting to throw this bazooka of stimulus at the economy, which might have made sense in 2009 because it was a balance sheet recession. But it doesn't make sense right now because we're it's not a balance sheet recession. When we reopen, things will more or less go back to normal relatively quickly without that just bazooka of stimulus there.
One of the I've got so many possible follow-ups.
Sorry, that was a long answer for our listeners.
No, it's really good because I think it's thorough and it lets us like be a little bit fractal. One of the micro questions is, just as a reminder for our listeners, what's the difference between fiscal and monetary stimulus?
So fiscal stimulus would be the federal government borrowing money and then spending it on something, right? The monetary stimulus is actually changing the amount of cash or cash equivalents in the system. So basically, monetary stimulus is the Federal Reserve pushing cash into financial markets to change the money supply. Whereas fiscal stimulus is basically borrowing money and then spending it to just kind of boost demand through that mechanism.
Yeah, the way I think about it is that monetary stimulus is like making it easy to borrow money so that like the market can go do stuff with that capital, and fiscal stimulus is the government is choosing where to spend that, building projects, stuff like that, to like, one, have infrastructure, but two, like employ people or otherwise like keep people employed.
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the thing too is there's also an argument to be made that at least the first few stimulus packages really weren't stimulus as much as relief, right?
Yes. Yes. Certainly. Yeah. Certainly this year, because people couldn't work, right? Normally your stimulus would be, hey, we're going to like put money out there in the hopes that it like gets people back to work and gets that flywheel going, because people make money and then they spend money and that employs more people.
Right.
The whole Keynesian thing. But if you're telling people they got to sit at home, you just got to give them food, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then also you have to try to keep businesses afloat, because like it's of course much easier to destroy a business than create one, right?
Yep.
So if you can keep businesses from being destroyed and you can keep them afloat, until this passes, you're much better off than if every restaurant in America fails, right?
Right.
And the whole industry has to start from scratch.
And speaking of which, one of the other things I want to pick on is you said that this bazooka feels unnecessary in part because it seems that because this isn't a balance sheet recession, the economy would snap back a bit more quickly. The Trump administration talked about a V-shaped recovery or someone said K-shaped. I don't even know what that means, but whatever. Maybe you'll be able to tell us. But given that there has been, to your point about it, it's harder to build a business than destroy it. I walk around downtown San Mateo and I see at least a few, four lease signs around that weren't around a year ago. And I suspect that is true of many towns in America. Are there some fundamental problems, besides the government debt load, are there some fundamental problems that would prevent the current, let's just say somehow we were just able to reopen tomorrow? It does seem like we're primed for growth, but are there fundamentals that would like keep that growth from just snapping back?
I mean, you're definitely going to have some drag effects, right? Because I mean, I don't know the numbers offhand, but right. But you know, but there definitely was quite a few, you know, in particular service sector oriented, you know, businesses that you know are gone, right? And then as mentioned, it's you know, starting a new business is not something that you know that happens on a dime, right? Someone has to be willing to take that risk. Someone has to develop the you know the idea, et cetera, et cetera. So I mean, it's I think that's been one of the things that it will hold us back to a degree, but I don't think that's but if we're comparing the amount that the balance sheet recession held us back in 2009 through 2011 versus how this holds us back now, it's just no comparison.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so while that's absolutely absolutely true, it's. That you know, these sort of balance sheet effects, whether it's in a boom or a deleveraging cycle, are the tide, right? I mean, it's just a massive effect. Whereas right. this is important, and you know, and of course, extremely real to the people who have experienced it. But looking at it, you know, looking at it in terms of the numbers that you know that we'll see from the economy, it's dollars and dimes versus dimes.
Right. And one of the things I'd been thinking about as I see these for lease signs up is that one, due in part to our it feels to me like historically different monetary policy of like ultra low interest rates, high capital availability. So you have banks with lots of money and they're looking for places to deploy that capital, and you have landlords with for lease signs up who are like, please somebody bloody lease this thing already, and therefore willing to adjust some prices. So it sounds like, it seems to me, at least by logic, that there's like a favorable environment for entrepreneurs to get access to capital at a very, very good price, and access to real estate at a very, very good price, and are therefore able, like, in a good position to be able to go make something happen.
Yeah, and the only thing that, and I would generally agree, and the only potential thing that maybe throws a bit of cold water on that is the difference in between how easily that capital available, how easily available that capital is to big companies versus small companies and you know and entrepreneurs, right? Because it's been a very big thing throughout this entire pandemic, and then you know, to a certain extent even before that before is a little more nuanced of an issue related to the nature of the banking system and such, but it tends to be the case that it's very, very easy for big companies to raise capital, and it's very, very difficult for you know small like mom and pop entrepreneurs to raise capital, and the engine of innovation doesn't tend to be the big companies, it tends to be new companies, right? Which right. Which tend to at least start small.
Right,
and then so that's going to be, and so I do see that as something that could very well hold people back, because hold the economy back, because the person who's the people who are coming in and looking to lease space and put in a restaurant or a bar or coffee shop or something like that, you know, it's not going to be Amazon that can borrow it like 2% or whatever, right? It's going to be someone wanting to do it who is going to go to their local bank and may not have an existing relationship that makes it easy for them to facilitate that.
Speaking of which, I remember, so we had Spike Cohen on the show like almost a year ago. For those who don't remember, he was the VP candidate for the Libertarian Party for 2020. And, you know, one of his like big criticisms of the way that the lockdown was managed was that in most states, the lockdown was like prohibitively painful and difficult for very small service companies like a salon, right? It was, the government, the state government go like, well, you don't need a haircut. So, okay, we'll shut down the salons. You don't need a bar. You don't need to drink in public. So we'll shut that down. We'll shut down the restaurants, all the little stuff. But, you know, you need to buy like toilet paper and food and such. So let's keep, let's definitely keep Walmart open, and let's keep Home Depot open, and let's keep, and Amazon, of course, they're delivering like crazy. They're making tons of money. And so what was interesting is he painted this picture of a medical regulatory environment. Regulatory environment is the wrong word, but these emergency measures, almost wartime measures, inadvertently created a, now he's a politician, so of course he said it was intentional, but but that inadvertently created an environment that like favored these really big corporations and hosed these really small mom and pop shops. And does it, and obviously Amazon made tons of money, Walmart made tons of money. Does it seem like we're going to see a permanent or semi-permanent, you know, consolidation where like, if we look kind of post-pandemic versus pre-pandemic, that like, I don't know that, like, what would be our statistic? Like it would be like revenue divided by number of companies or something like that, like goes up, right? Where you have like fewer companies, like fewer just total corporations out there, and like more of the services that we interact with are consolidating into fewer and fewer big companies, as opposed to, you know, is it sort of like the doom of the mom and pop shop? Are these small companies kind of like not going to bounce back? I don't know how else to ask it, but those were eight ways of asking the same thing.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of really interesting dimensions here. And so I think first off, and this is just kind of, you know, provide a little context to what you just laid out here. You know, if you look at actually the spending in sectors of the economy throughout the pandemic, certain consumption sectors, durables, right? Durable goods would be like a washing machine or right. Stuff like that. That actually rose, right? And the reason that arose is because of the fall of the spending in the service sector, right? As you say, people can't go get a haircut or buy a beer at a bar or go out to eat at a restaurant or whatever. So a certain portion of that money is now being spent in the good sector rather than services. And I don't know the numbers offhand. Though I should, because I was looking at them today. But
I should. It's my job.
Yes. Yeah. I want to say at one point the spending on services, you know, it might have been on Q3 of 2020 had fallen, you know, something like over 50% from what it was before the pandemic. So it was somewhere in that ballpark. I mean, and I can't remember if it was. I can't remember if it was 50%. Yeah, I think it was like 60%, or had fallen like 40% year over year. Or something in that ballpark. And then, you know, as you mentioned, some of that is going to go towards durable goods. But the thing I think in terms of concentration that's really interesting is that I very much would expect that concentration to increase in the more good sector, right? And, you know, we've seen that for decades with stores. Right. I mean, the mom and pop store versus Walmart or Target. I mean, that transition is almost over. Right.
Right.
In a lot of ways. But I don't see that sort of. I don't see the shift from goods, from services to goods as being something that continues. Right. Because once people are able to travel and go to a restaurant, go to a bar, go to a nail salon or hair salon or whatever, you know, they're going to go back to doing that. You know, human preferences, didn't change in that front. And those sectors, the service sector tends to be much more oriented towards the mom and pop places, right? I mean, like, as far as I'm aware, there really aren't that many like chain barber shops, right?
Right.
You know, or chain bars that, you know, the people really. The chains aren't dominating the sector, and I don't expect
right.
Whereas that's a transition that's basically happened already on the good side.
Got it. Cool. The other thing I was thinking about regarding the recovery is, oh my god, it's felt like we were in a bubble forever, and I feel like last time we talked, I said this, and it feels like even worse now in some ways, at least to me, and. I think some of it, the two things that come to mind, like thinking about this potential recovery, actually there are three things that come to mind, but the two in the private sector are, you know, PE ratios are very high. And by very high, I mean like, you know, make my financial advisor want to jump out a window high, and debt ratios seem very high. Now, access to capital is very cheap, so you can like refinance and stuff like that. But I don't know the numbers at all, but it does seem like both of those are very high, and both of those seem dangerous. And I was like, look, I'll be honest, when the pandemic hit, you know, I wrote this like whole treatise about how this was going to be a truly like centennial level depression, right? These debt ratios are already high. The stock market is already overinflated. The government already has a ton of debt. I mean, I think you and I talked about this last time. We talked about like goosing the economy in a time when it was hot. And it meant that the government, with the U.S. federal government, would have, this was for the Trump tax cut. that the U.S. federal government would have like less ability to do that the next time it really needed it. And now this was more me saying it, and you were kind of talking about the options. So this was like my prediction that was cripplingly wrong, but I feel like my prediction was cripplingly wrong last time that we were in a bubble and it was going to burst. But it feels like we're in a bubble again. So I don't know. This is in part why I kind of had my like coma question, because it just feels like, again, it feels like we're living in this different world now. But like, would conventional, like, would you know, if you got a bunch of economists in a room together, like, would they say we're in a bubble, or would they say that, like, you know, that we're actually primed for growth?
So the thing is, right, like as you mentioned, there's, you know, things like PE ratios, which, by the way, PE ratios refers to price to earnings. So yep. Equity prices relative to corporate earnings. If you think about what a stock should be worth in the long term, it should be in some sense worth, driven by what sort of earnings the company is bringing in, right? So the idea here, when we talk about PE ratios or other valuation measures like the total market cap to GDP and such, we're talking about, are stocks expensive relative to some underlying fundamentals, right? And they've been expensive relative to underlying fundamentals for quite some time. And actually, I think we're finally approaching levels that are, you know, on par or are around what we saw near the end of the dot-com bubble. So I mean, while I wouldn't go so far as to say that necessarily means that we're in a bubble, I mean, and I would agree that risk is there, you know, for sure. But the big difference between what those ratios mean right now versus in say 2000, or so, is the effect of interest rates on what we would expect those ratios to be. So if you think about what a stock should be valued, just, you know, very abstractly based on these earnings that are coming in.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If interest rates are low and then earnings way in the future are discounted using low interest rates rather than high interest rates, the present value of that dividend in 20 years or something is a lot higher. Yeah. So you can quite easily justify higher valuations, right now when interest rates are like zero compared to in 1999 or 2000 when the 10-year yield was something like 6.5% ish, something like that. It's
an unimaginable number now.
That would be catastrophic if it happened today.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, so I mean, and there's something similar going on with like debt loads, and this is both public debt loads and corporate debt loads in general. If you look at the trajectory of both of them, starting in say 1950, because I'm gonna just make my argument easier and ignore World War II, right?
Yeah, exactly.
and its effects on the debt. But you know, if you start 50, 60 years ago, something like that, what you see is this more or less long term trajectory of falling interest rates, with them finally, you know, at what we think is around the floor right now, about as low as they can go, but we'll see. And then correspondingly, this long-term increase in debt loads, and of course there's a rationale behind this, right? If you're paying 1% on your debt, you can carry and support a much higher debt load than if you're paying 8%, right? Yeah. Like what we saw like in the late 70s and such. And so while it's very much the case that that both these valuation measures and these debt measures, you know, suggest a non-trivial level of risk, as long as interest rates are low, that, you know, there's a decent chance that, you know, that risk doesn't manifest. And then speaking to your point about because there wasn't as much space as expected for fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus based on the growing deficits and falling interest rates in 2018, I wouldn't necessarily say that perspective is wrong per se, but the limit of how far we could go before we hit that problem, before we run out of money we can borrow, for fiscal policy or cash we can create for monetary stimulus and such. The limits are just, apparently, a lot higher than most people, myself included, thought was likely the case, a few years ago. But I mean, I feel like very few economists would argue that those limits are there,
Right.
But any economist that takes a hard stance on where those limits are, I probably am not going to consider very trustworthy because, we just don't have a good idea. So, I mean, yeah. So I think just briefly kind of wrap it up and summarize it. The risk of a big correction is there, but the reason that things are operating differently now, and we've had this long run growth in valuations, this long run growth in debt, is because the low interest rates can support it. Mm-hmm. Now, so off the top of your head, what's been happening with long run interest rates in the past 3 months?
Something about like yield curves. I don't know.
Yeah. So this is where things get interesting, and this is where the diciness could come into play.
Right.
And now, I'm not saying I think this is going to happen or even likely to happen. But it is a real possibility. Is that what's been happening over the past 4 months is the U.S. 10-year sovereign yield has risen by about 0.75%, right? Which is a sharp rise right now. And we're still pretty far away from where, in my view, we would start to create stress in debt markets. And there's a variety of technical reasons for that I feel like we probably don't want to dive into. But if interest rates continue to sharply rise, then all of a sudden those equity valuations, become untenable, right? The debt load, could become untenable. So these rising interest rates are the thing to watch out for, Right. and it's a tail risk. It's not a base case, but it's a relevant tail risk.
And to help me and therefore I'm sure some of our listeners better understand. So this is the 10-year interest rate, and that 10-year interest rate is the interest rate on essentially like the government floats a bond and it sells it on the open market. And it says, who wants to buy this bond? And I'm going to adjust the interest rates on this bond. So it's an investment. And I'm going to adjust the interest rates on this bond. And when I find a price, or the price is driven by supply and demand, right? And right now there's a lot of the government wants to release a lot of these. And at some point what's going to happen, or what's like when that interest rate goes up, it's because it can't find enough buyers at the lower interest rate. So it has to raise the interest rate to get people to buy it. And raising the interest rate means that when we sell this bond, let's say we borrow $1 trillion at a higher interest rate, means we need to pay back more than at a lower interest rate. And therefore this interest rate going up creates a potential debt challenge for the U.S. federal government in the future. What am I missing?
Oh, the one thing I would add to that would just be that the 10-year yield is, of course, it's directly the cost that the U.S. government borrows at over a 10-year time frame, right? But it also is a very, very key driver of what the private sector borrows at. Right. As well, because it's of course not like a one to one relationship in terms of the movements. But I mean, if the U.S. 10-year moves, corporate borrowing at the same maturity is very much going to track it for the most part. So when I say the U.S. 10-year sovereign, I'm using it as a proxy more so for just like borrowing cost overall.
Right
now, okay. and the only thing I would kind of mention about your comments on the the rise in 10-year, why it's doing so, is that actually it is driven by supply and demand, it is a market price, but in practice it's very, very much driven by demand more so than supply movements, because it's such a liquid market that changes in the supply of the 10-year, or even U.S. government debt in general isn't really what tends to drive the movement. What tends to drive the movement is market perceptions of the inflation outlook over that time frame. So you know, if markets think that inflation is gonna go up quite a bit, then, well, all right, I'm not buying that bond at 1% because it means I'm gonna lose money in real terms, right, if inflation rises to 2.5% or whatever. Right. So if markets start expecting higher inflation, they, you know, it pushes that yield up to, you know, correspond to inflation. So, you know, so really the big driver of these long run borrowing rates for the government, and therefore for the, you know, for everyone else for the most part, is the inflation outlook. And the inflation outlook has shifted a lot in the past 4 months or so. I mean, I think market perceptions of the, and this is, you know, again, a technical market based, you know, assessment, but you know, based on derivatives, but the market expectation of inflation, of, you know, inflation rates over the next 5 years has risen by, I want to say, almost a full percentage over the past 4 months.
Yeah. And that's okay. And that's what's driving that 10-year yield up.
Yep. Yeah. That's really the key driver. So this idea of, you know, rising inflation expectations, pushing interest rates up, and then how those interest rates affect whether the current equity valuations are justified and the current debt levels are sustainable, right? That potential for the 10-year yield to, you know, it continue rising by, you know, quite a bit is what creates that tail risk of those equity valuations not being appropriate, or, you know, being, you know, or those equity valuations resetting and, you know, and crashing a bit, or you know, and debt becoming not sustainable. So, you know, so that's really the risk there. But again, I see that as a tail risk and very much not a base case.
Right. Yeah. I think it's inflation. I remember, you know, there've been a lot of, I don't know who to listen to, but like, there've been a lot of kind of like doomsayers about inflation for the past almost 15 or since 2008, basically. None of them have come to pass. Now, the other thing I often think about is, I don't know if you've seen this, but so I'm a big Friedrich Hayek fan, and now I know he's been dead longer than we've been alive, but I remember specifically, I've actually read his books, but one of the things that comes to mind specifically is the rap battle YouTube video between Friedrich Hayek and John Maynard Keynes.
I'm familiar with that.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Yep. So
yeah, that's George Mason, the George Mason economist.
Exactly.
I think put that together. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's obviously, so like, So, disclaimer, it's a very pro Hayek bias to this rap battle, but I'll post both rap battles in the show notes. It's quite
entertaining. Oh yeah, there is a second, isn't there?
There's a second. Yeah. It's the second is the one where he's going into security and they, you know, they put on a latex glove for him.
Yeah.
Anyway. So during this rap battle, I remember specifically Friedrich Hayek is talking about like the low interest rate boom is frightening, not because of inflation, but because it's going to create a bubble. And the reason it's going to create a bubble is that like massive capital availability is going to cause this like what's snapping up of resources for, you know, essentially you have like more money than you have like places you can put it. And because there's like only so much labor and only so much material, now maybe that's changed in the digital age, but I had always, you know, my grasp of economics is certainly not PhD level or even bachelor's level, but my impression is that one of the risks of sustained long-term very low interest rates is that the too much capital availability is in fact a bad thing. And what I think I'm hearing from you is that low interest rates mean capital availability is high, and this is actually good for now because it allows us to, like, you know, get capital at good debt at you know, good prices, get money at good prices, and like sustain the like long-term future outlook of, you know, a profit of these companies, and therefore keep their valuations high. So there's not a risk of that collapsing. But what about this like Hayekian idea of essentially creating a bubble?
Yeah. So there's, there's definitely an element of truth there, right? And I think pretty much, you know, I don't want to say every, but you know, at minimum, you know, the vast majority of economists that study the financial sector and, you know, the international financial system will tell you, yeah, I mean, there, you know, there's definitely risks associated with too low interest rates as you end up funneling money towards unproductive endeavors, and you build up some of this bubbly type behavior and, you know, and things of that nature. I think there's a lot of markers right now that it's a concern. right? And that would actually, and this is really just kind of the counterpoint of of what I was talking about previously, right? Because because while there's certainly an argument to be made that that the valuations can be appropriate at these low interest rates, well, the interest rates aren't going to be that low forever, right? And so and so what we're almost talking about here is two sides of the exact same coin, right? So the sort of tail risk that I'm talking about here with rising interest rates would, in a certain sense, just kind of be Hayek's perspective manifest, to a certain extent, right? Because it definitely is the case that if interest rates are too low, right, too low being something distinctly different from just low, you do create this risk, when things revert back to towards a normal functioning financial market, can cause this risk to manifest. So I definitely think that's a risk, and I think to a certain extent what we're looking at here is what you talk about with this question and what I was talking about previously as almost just two slightly different ways of saying similar thing, right? But I would say looking at what this Hayekian idea of low interest rates and stimulus in general, monetary fiscal creating bubbles is to really look at the markers of that, and there are markers in the standard financial system for sure, right? I mean, there's a bunch of like red flags, but there's plenty of yellow flags out very much in line with this with this perspective. But the big place that I would really point at to say that, hey, there's definitely some behavior that's looking bubbly is like crypto and like NFTs and things of that nature. And then parts of the stock market. I mean, looking at the whole like GME and AMC thing. Yeah. I mean, that's not something that happens in normal, well functioning market. Right. That's something that happens, when a bunch of people are, one, not able to spend money on anything because they're stuck at home, and two, have a bunch of cash on hand because, a large portion of the population is still working and has received, I'm not sure, several stimulus checks, over the past year. And then that money is just flooding into these unproductive investments. And that's a big part of why we've seen some of the behavior of the stock market that we have, because people who are bored and can't spend money or, bet on sports are playing around with like GME calls, right?
Right.
Which is, just kind of a nut situation, but it's what's happening right now. And then, I think probably even the clearer one is these NFTs, which is basically creating a non-fungible token for like a video or like an image or something like that. Right. And, the sort of thing that, you would normally just go watch on YouTube, and now it's costing you money or something to buy it and own it. Right. And these are kind of the behaviors that to me are much more clear markers of there being frothiness in markets, and there being some of that speculative mania. And I'm not at all saying that it doesn't exist in the equity market in general to a certain extent. But I mean, it's just so clear in areas like these NFTs and crypto and the meme stocks that to me that's the spot where I think it's just crystal clear that there's that the situation that we're in, where everyone's stuck at home and getting handed cash, has created this to a certain extent bubbly environment. But right. I mean, but the thing is too is part of this is that because we're stuck at home in a pandemic, markets are just not functioning like they would generally in terms of getting resources to where they need to be, right? So I mean, so normally if this was happening, I'd be much more concerned about the state of the economy as a whole. Right. But I think right now, where there's been just all these unprecedented actions taken to try to protect businesses and try to keep things afloat while this is going on by just kind of throwing money at the problem. I mean, I think this is almost just the fact that money is not going to be allocated efficiently is just a given. Right. Given the way that it was dispersed. And then the places that, it went where it didn't need to go to. Yeah, that's going to create bubbly behavior in places. But I think that's more of a microscopic problem than a macroscopic problem.
Mm.
In the sense of whether whether that's suggestive of true bubbly behavior in the overall macro market.
And the just so you don't get any like death threat from any meme stonk investors at in the Reconsider audience, you're not saying that like, you know, retail investing is bad, because I think I've heard some like defensiveness about this. It's more that this is a sick, like it is one of the, you know, people looking for like, where am I going to put my money, and speculating heavily on NFTs, on Bitcoin and crypto, on certain, you know, memetic stocks, like, and you're really betting on like other people's kind of like wild speculation as opposed to the fundamentals of the stock, because nobody would ever say that GME is worth $200
on its own,
right? It's just not. And so that level of speculation being so obvious and so blatant by a large portion of the population, not just your conventional, or not a large portion, but by retail investors, as opposed to just your conventional hedge fund folks whose like job it is to speculate in a hedge way, it's just a sign that there is a fair amount of capital availability, and the thing I think I'm hearing is that they're like, folks don't have like don't feel like obvious good or obvious traditional places to put their money, such as like my underperforming mutual funds are a good place to put it, because, you know, that's like sort of the nature of speculation, is that like a bunch of people put money into something, it goes up, and other people go like, holy smokes, it's going up, I want to put money into it too.
Right. Yeah. And the point that you make about it, you know, about retail stocks versus, you know, versus the specific GME thing is very true. Right. I mean, I'm very much not making the case that, that retail investors shouldn't be doing that. You know, it's great that they are, but there's a difference in between a sustainable long-term investment process, undertaken by a retail investor, and then a bunch of people who are bored because they're locked at home, kind of talking to each other like, hey, let's pump GMB to the moon, right?
I mean, they're strong. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's just not indicative of a healthy, sustainable, well-functioning market.
Right. The other thing I wanted to ask about was, you know, federal debt, because we did mention this a little earlier in the show. We mentioned it last time. But I think federal debt to GDP ratio went up to something like 130% in 2020. And that is, of course, the highest it's ever been ever in the United States. Because I think in World War II is like 105, end of World War II is like 105 or something.
Yeah, yeah. We did crack the World War II ceiling.
Yeah, by a bit, by a good bit.
Not by a little bit.
And, yeah. And of course, what's interesting is what happened right after World War II. Well, massive infrastructure spending, but also super duper high taxes. You know, that like Eisenhower's famous like 93% top marginal tax rate, which like, I guess it's one of the nice things about a wartime economy is you can like get away with doing that. Can't so much do that in a peacetime economy. So with this very high, you know, and so like there are some things that look like they're parallels, and the 50s, 60s, 70s are great, but is there, you know, are we getting to a point where, you know, US debt GDP ratio is so high that risk averse investors are going to be less interested in taking on US debt at a good price? And therefore like debt servicing starts to become a meaningful burden to the US federal government, especially in a time when there's a lot of demand to spend more. Right, both on infrastructure, but also like healthcare and stuff like that. Do you see any risks there to, yeah, I mean, generally the economy? Because of course, if debt servicing becomes a major factor, you'd have to just spend less domestically or tax more domestically, or both.
Yeah. So, and I want to briefly kind of digress and just add that a big part of the falling debt load relative to GDP, right, which is of course the only real metric that matters, right? In the post World War II era, was because also given that we were coming out of the Great Depression and then like Europe was covered in a layer of rubble, there was like a period of an extended period of like 4 or 5% like GDP growth, right? Right. So, to a certain extent, there wasn't even so much that debt was being paid back. The raw debt load was being neutralized, and the economy was just booming, right? And it just very quickly became a lot smaller by comparison,
right?
And I think the thing that's tricky is that while we're looking at probably a very near term boom, of like a year or so,
yeah.
The outlook for long term sustainable GDP growth right now is probably more like 2% instead of, you know, 4 or 5%. So Word is not going to have that extended very high growth that you know that more or less neutralizes that debt like we saw in like the 50s and 60s. So I mean, and that creates a problem, you know, for sure. Now the other option in terms of how this debt would most likely be dealt with would be to inflate it away, right? Because and inflating it away would be much more would be something that's much more politically palatable than actually just really hiking taxes very high, right? And more often than not, I mean, just because of the way that politics, you know, function, when you have unsustainable debt loads, the country either defaults, which the U.S. will not do, or inflates it away. I mean, it's pretty rare unless there's significant external pressure from, you know, from like the IMF, you know, the World Bank, you know, to see these, you know, large deficit, or I'm sorry, large surpluses paying down debt, well, outside of oil producing countries, right?
Right.
In the end, the IMF is not going to come in and pressure the United States to, you know, run a primary surplus. That's just not going to happen. So the issue, so the next thing you look at in terms of what they might do would be to try to inflate the debt away. Yeah. And now where this becomes a problem is if we think back to what I was talking about previously about that inflation interest rate and then, you know, stability of, you know, of debt markets, a relationship that I talking about previously, you know, because if you see inflation rising, well, then what's that going to do to, you know, to long-term interest rates? Well, you know, long-term interest rates are, you know, very much driven by inflation, or I should say inflation expectations. So, you know, if the government tries to inflate it away, now you run the risk of triggering that tail risk that I talked about previously, you know, in terms of equity markets, which would be problematic, but probably not devastating if you really trigger that, you know, in the macro sense. You could trigger that risk in equity markets, but more importantly, what that could do in like corporate debt markets and such, right? Because corporate debt markets are in the short term and relatively good shape right now, which I think would be shocking to a lot of people. But the reason the reason that I say that they're in very good shape is that basically when long term interest rates went to like zero, you know, throughout the pandemic, everyone just loaded up on zero interest rate debt. So the corporate sector has a whole bunch of you know debt that isn't due for 10 more years and a whole bunch of cash, you know, sitting on balance sheets.
And I assume they're able to even restructure old debt.
Oh yeah. Well, that's kind of what the cash, you know, to a certain extent what the cash sitting on balance sheets is for, right? Because if they have old debts coming due in the next 3 years, then and interest rates went to zero, what do you do? You just raise a bunch more capital. You let it sit on a balance sheet and prepare to pay it. You know, to pay the pay it back when the bond comes due. Right.
Right.
And this is a bit more technical, but I'll kind of keep it high level. But if you look at the amount they're still able to raise it out at the moment, versus what they have to actually pay out in coupon payments, which is a very cash flow, you know, day-to-day oriented sort of consideration, the interest rate they're borrowing at is still way below what they have to pay to service, right? Not even to roll over. So the corporate sector is pretty well insulated right now. But the issue becomes is that if the government, you know, does try to inflate away debt, then now you're talking, you know, now you're talking high inflation for an extended period of time, you know, and then you could actually, you know, start to trigger, you know, trigger vulnerabilities in the corporate debt market, because even though in terms of, you know, of a cash and a cash flow sense, the corporate sector is, you know, quite good at the moment. You know, one, the, you know, smaller businesses are very much likely not, and it, you know, with their borrowing and such, and two, the, you know, the debt loads are huge and they do have to eventually roll it over or, you know, or pay it down. And then if that, and then if inflation and their, you know, and their poor interest rates are very, very high when that does, you know, come due in, you know, seven, eight years and such, when they start, having to roll it over, then now you very well might have a problem. Right. Mm-hmm. So circling back to the base idea of what we started with here, in terms of dealing with the debt load, if the U.S. government's going to reduce it, one, the extremely high growth that dealt with after World War II is very, very unlikely to happen. Two, right. there there's, you know, a lot of structural risks that come in the financial sector that come with these, that come with this, you know, this, that come with any attempt to try to deal with it by inflating it away. And then there's, you know, it's very unlikely that there's the political will to deal with it by either cutting budgets or, you know, or raising taxes. So it seems to me that I would not be surprised if we see this very large debt load just sit on the balance sheet for, you know, this very large debt load to GDP just sit there for, you know, a very extended, you know, amount of time. But, you know, much like with Japan, which I want to say has their debt to GDP somewhere north of, or before the pandemic, they had north of 200%. And it had been sitting there for, you know, for quite a while. So, you know, from a debt sustainability standpoint, I mean, I think that what we're going to start to see is a return towards more fiscally prudent, you know, spending patterns in the medium term. But I would be very surprised if we see any of the factors that could reduce the debt load actually come to pass.
Yeah. So yes, right now Japan has approximately twice the debt load we do at 266%, which is horrifying to imagine. But you know, Japan has not collapsed. Of course, Japan's GDP has stagnated since the, you know, 80s, 90s boom. Is that due to their debt load, or was that driven by, you know, they were doing import substitution and tried to wean themselves off that towards a more liberal economy or something else?
I mean, that's a bit of a $1 million question, right? just to kind of quickly throw a couple thoughts out there. I mean, there was Japan, you know, Japan kind of, you know, over that time period was undergoing a big demographic shift, right? Which creates a lot of structural pressures towards lower interest rates and such as the population aged, and then, you know, and also increased debt loads from spending associated with that, and then they also for quite a while were undergoing a relative mild price deflation, but a relatively large tangible asset price deflation. Right, you know, and things like real estate and things like that. So that sort of balance sheet, you know, that balance sheet sort of deleveraging cycle that we had that held back our, you know, growth for, you know, and from like 2009 to 2000, well, you know, for like 5 years after that, Japan basically had going on for like the entirety of the 90s. Right. So that combination of that deleveraging cycle and then the demographic shift are the big things that I would you know, start to point to. But that's not something I want to sit here and say that, oh, that's my confident answer. Yeah. Right. Just a couple of things that I would point to.
I think the reason I asked was like, ooh, are we going to go the way of Japan? Which is like not the worst thing, but it's not the best thing either. And it sounds like the indicators are not like it sounds like government debt load was not the thing that stagnated Japan necessarily.
Yeah, that was more of an effect than a cause.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Because when GDP doesn't grow, your debt GDP ratio doesn't shrink.
Yeah. Ta-da. And then you're collecting less tax revenues and likely paying out more in like social spending and such. Yep. So,
yes. And along with your population getting older and all that stuff. Yep. Yep, it makes sense. What's interesting is like, In a way that I don't know how to articulate to myself, but I feel like less horrified about the future than I thought I would be. But it still feels like there's this kind of like just there's this like weird mystery to it where we're just like kind of wondering how far we can push it, like how far we can push government debt and how far we can like we can push interest rates for how long to kind of like keep things chugging along here. And so maybe this is an opportunity for me to just ask you, like, kind of given everything we've talked about and everything that I failed to ask, like, what do you think is going to happen?
I mean, so the thing is, right, is if we look at what's happening in the economy right now, we're very much getting boosted by, you know, all this money that's being thrown at it, right? But, you know, on fiscal and monetary stimulus, which will stop, right? The fiscal stimulus will probably turn into a net negative. Well, I mean, the fiscal stimulus will probably more or less stop in the next couple quarters. Whereas the monetary, you know, stimulus probably won't start to be rolled back for a couple more years. So what I expect to see is you know, a very strong growth for, you know, for the remainder of the year as the stimulus gets spent, the money that people have saved up, because there's a huge amount of excess savings floating out there in the economy right now, or I shouldn't say the economy, but in financial markets right now and bank accounts and things of that nature. And then those two things combined with, you know, just base reopening effects, right? People being able to, you know, travel and go out to places and you know, spend money that way. I would expect to see, you know, to see very, very strong, you know, economic growth over the next year or so. But the problem becomes is that after that, you know, boom this year, will, you know, that fiscal stimulus that created the boom is unlikely to be replaced. You know, the savings, the pent-up savings that are being spent, like, are going to be gone. You know, once you've reopened, you aren't reopening again, right? So what I expect to see is that once we get through this initial just very big boom that we're probably going to see throughout the remainder of the year, is that we start to see a fairly significant drag in the year or two after that, as all these factors that had combined just create that big push, right, to GDP and the economy, right, just, you know, go away and are finished, but, you know, without replacement. I mean, so that's kind of the big thing. And financial markets, I mean, I think a very important thing that was driving the big equities booms previously was this, was people kind of pushing money into the market because there was, you know, there wasn't really anywhere else to spend it. And that's going to go away, right? So, you know, so those sorts of upward pressures in equities. Mm. And then I would argue probably more importantly in areas like crypto and NFTs are probably going to probably going to go away. So, I mean, I think there is, you know, a fair bit of risk of, you know, at least a moderate equities correction coming up. Yeah. Interest rates, I mean, I expect interest rates to, you know, to keep rising for probably another year or so. And then, long-term interest rates keep rising for probably another year or so, and then start, and then probably after that point, go back to their long-term secular downward trend, unless the government does try to inflate away the debt, which is a realistic possibility. And then I would say, aside from that, I mean, I think the only other really big thing that is extremely uncertain, kind of on the economic outlook, at least on the policy outlook, would be the infrastructure package,
right?
So, and my understanding is right now there's a phase one proposed at like $2.2 trillion, which is maybe like half what we would consider traditional infrastructure and half that's maybe not quite there. And then there's a phase two, like $1 trillion package that is very much seems to be kind of social spending just packaged and you know, with an infrastructure label. And so I think the thing is with the economic effects of these. So first off, the phase one package passing more or less what it looks like now is not going to surprise me. The phase two package, I do not expect to look anything like that, or to look close to that when it does get passed, because I would expect moderate Democrats to balk at that a bit. But one thing that we're seeing right now in some, you know, corners of the, you know, the discussion is people talking about the stimulative effect of the infrastructure package, you know, and while that very well might be the case on a 5-year timeline in terms of boosting up, you know, long-term growth, in the near term, I think people are so used to these big packages being just, you know, passed and dispersed that they're kind of forgetting that the infrastructure package is one. It's proposed that it's about, you know, half tax funded, you know, which, you know, so obviously cuts that $2.2 trillion in half in terms of the stimulative effect. But then also it's expected to be dispersed over, you know, over about 10 years. Right. So you're really looking at like $100 billion a year, which is not meaningless, right, in terms of stimulus. But I mean, it's not this bazooka package that we saw in March and December, right, and, you know, last April and March. Right. So, I mean, I think I would say that given that, I think people are going to be surprised how strong economic growth is this year and surprised how weak it is the year after that.
Cool. I like it. And I've chewed up an hour of your time. Dr. Jake Meyer, where can listeners who want to learn more about how you think about the economy hear about how you think about the economy? or read about it?
So actually the best place would be, so in my job at Swiss Re, one of the things that I write and we publish is the U.S. macroeconomic outlook, and it comes out once a month. So you can get it at the, you can go to the Swiss Re Institute. It's published the second week of every month. It's just a very short 2-page newsletter, kind of laying out what we think about the economy. I'll also post it on social media and LinkedIn and such, so you can find it there. But yeah, we at the Institute publish a global macro outlook, or I should say a global macro and financial risks, 2-page news or several page newsletter every month as well. So I mean, if you're interested in hearing more about what we at Swiss Re think about what's going on in the macro economy, I definitely suggest checking those out.
Excellent. I'm going to put those up on the show notes, everyone. So just go to reconsidermedia.com, go to the latest episode. Unless you listen to this for a while, and then just go to podcasts, find search tags for Jake Meyer, and you'll find all of our Jake Meyer episodes. And you can see, what's cool about this is we've got a kind of an archive. You can go back a few years and see, what did Jake and Eric think about what's going to happen to the world, and find out how we did. I have re-listened recently. I'm not going to spoil anything too much, but it's actually really fascinating. So anyway, to hear more about Jake's stuff or read more about Jake's stuff, go to Swiss Re. If you can't find it on your own, go to the show notes for this episode and follow those links from there. So
you can actually do newsletter subscriptions as well. And we have another series called Economic Insights. It's not technically the macro outlook, but it's quite interesting stuff. I published, me and my colleague and I published one recently on the U.S. housing market, for example. So it's all just select topics. So if you head there and you can sign up for the email newsletter, you might find it quite interesting. Hopefully.
Awesome. Dr. Jake Meyer, thank you so much for joining us once again. A ball as always. Listeners, hope you enjoyed. Feedback is always welcome. Eric at reconsidermedia.com. And Jake, stay safe. We'll see you. I'll see you when we're all vaccinated.
Yep. Sounds good. Thanks again.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.